It's possible he got a warning through to Ryvich, though. Possible, yes. But if he did, Ryvich isn't acting on it. The weapons traces are still moving at the normal rate towards us. Then, essentially, nothing's changed, right? Essentially, nothing, I said, but we both knew that neither of us felt it. Shortly afterwards, his men made the turbine sing again, and we were on our way. I had always taken the security of the expedition seriously, but now I had redoubled my efforts and rethought all my arrangements. No one was leaving camp unless they were armed, and no one was to leave alone, except, of course, for Kaweya himself, who would still insist on his nocturnal prowls. The camp we set tonight would form the basis of our ambush, so I was determined to spend more than the usual amount of time searching for the best place to pitch the bubble tents. The camp had to be nearly invisible from the road, but close enough that we could mount an attack on Ryvich's group. I did not want us to become too separated from our munitions stores, which meant placing the tents no more than 50 or 60 meters into the trees. Before nightfall, we could scythe out strategic lines of fire through the wood and arrange fallback routes for ourselves in case Ryvich's men laid down a heavy suppressing fire. If time allowed, we would set deadfalls or mines along other more obvious paths. I was drawing a map in my mind, crisscrossing it with intersecting lines of death, when the snake began to cross our path. My attention had wandered slightly from the route ahead, so it was Kaweya shouting, "Stop!" which first alerted me that something was happening. Turbines cut, our vehicles bellied down. 200 or 300 meters down the trail, just where the trail began to curve out of sight, the Hamadryad had poked its head out of the curtain of greenery which marked the edge of the jungle. The head was a pale, sickly green, under the olive folds of its photosensitive cowl, retracted like a cobra's hood. It was crossing from left to right towards the sea. "Near adult," Dieterling said, as if what we were looking at was a bug stuck to the windshield. The head was nearly as big as one of our vehicles. Behind it came the first few meters of the creature's snake-like body. The patterning was the same as I had seen on the helical structure wrapped around the Hamadryad tree, very snake-like. "How big do you think it is?" I asked. 30, 35 meters. Not the biggest I've ever seen. That has to be a 60-meter snake I saw back in 71. But this isn't any juvenile. If it can find a tree which reaches the canopy and isn't much higher than its length, it'll probably begin fusion. The head had reached the other side of the road. It moved slowly, creeping past us. "Take us closer," Kaweya said. "Wait," I said. "Are you sure? We're safe here. It'll pass soon. I know they don't have any deeply wired defensive instincts, but it might still decide we look like something worth eating. Are you sure you want to risk that?" "Take us closer." I fired up the turbine, gunning it to the minimum number of revs sufficient to give us lift, and crept the vehicle forward. Hamadryads were thought to have no sense of sound, but seismic vibrations were another thing entirely. I wondered whether the air cushion of our car, drumming against the ground, sounded exactly like part of the snake's diet coming closer. The snake had arced itself so that the length of 2-meter-thick body spanning the road was always elevated. It continued to move slowly and smoothly, betraying absolutely no sign that it had even registered our presence. Perhaps Dieterling was right. Perhaps all the snake was interested in was finding a nice tall tree to curl itself around, so that it could give up this tedious business of having a brain and having to move around. We were 50 meters from it now. "Stop,"